Welcome to Don't Split the Party. We're attempting an outdoor podcast today, and while we're grilling and having fun with the whole family. And we're going to be talking a little bit today about, well, all sorts of things, mainly weapons and fighters. Jay, what were you saying?
I was saying that there's an interesting sort of assumption going on in the background of D&D that at a certain point, the entire party is just a fighter support team.
And why do you say that?
Well, I don't know. It's just sort of set up that way. Fighters reach name level faster than almost anyone else, and they get the,
except for monks,
and they get the most in-depth strategic ruling rules. Plus, they've got more magic items listed than anyone else, and there's always the implication that they're the party leader.
That sounds good. Paladin's a fighter.
What was a paladin?
A fighter.
Right. So it sounds right, but what did D&D come from? She came from chainmail, and of course it came from board games, so the first sort of characters were heroes and superheroes.
Yeah.
So they were. At first you had fighters, and it was all about fighters on the battlefield, and everyone else was literally just support.
Oh. Oh yeah, that's true, isn't it?
Yeah, so all you're seeing there is the lattice work underneath. You know, you're looking behind the curtain and realizing that when push comes to shove, this was always about Charlemagne, not about Malagrus.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. And we're also talking about weapon adjustments versus armor type. I personally think that if you're going to get rid of armor type adjustments in first edition, you got to adjust the weapons.
Which is true, because otherwise no one would ever use the flail.
Or the Lucerne hammer.
Well, the Lucerne hammer, yeah, the flail in particular. The flail in particular gets huge bonuses against
the flail
any type.
Is awesome if you actually use the armor class adjustments.
But otherwise, there's no reason not to just use a mace instead.
Exactly.
Which has better damage, but and yes, space required.
Yeah.
Right, so why would you use a flail? Because of that sweet adjustment against armor types. And
oddly
also...
Oddly enough, this dynamic is duplicated in 4th edition of all places, where the flail is your go-to accuracy weapon.
Interesting. Hmm. So did 4th edition fix something that you break when you get rid of armor type adjustments in 1st edition?
Actually, yes.
Isn't that interesting?
4th edition fixed something! The world is going to explode!
Well, I don't think we have to be quite that snarky about 4th edition. Even though I personally have never personally played 4th edition. Now, you're also saying something about the Ransoor?
Yeah, if you take the rules as presented in the book, it looks like every fighter should use a Ransoor. Because all you have to do to disarm someone with a Ransoor is hit armor class 8. And if I got my first impression of the rules correctly, that's just on your normal attack roll. If you happen to also hit armor class 8, you disarm them.
Well, yeah, but you can't disarm a Zwagon or Owlbear or anything like that.
But what's more dangerous than another leveled character, especially at high levels? Nothing.
Well, another leveled character who also has a Ransoor.
Yeah, there you go.
Well, really. So, of course, if we're using the old school, you tied for initiative rules, then we get wonky. Two fighters, both of Ransoor as a tie, have the same dexterity, could potentially
disarm
each other while injuring each other at the exact same time. That's one of the reasons I have my own unique initiative rules that do not follow first edition house rules.
Although having your attacks resolve simultaneously on very rare occasions does add a level of drama to certain battles.
It does, but it still can occur in my system.
Yeah.
It can. Now, where else do we have any rules for disarming in D&D first edition, other than under the Ransoor and a few other weapons?
Flint bars,
which are a Fiend Folio madness there. And how do flint bars work?
Hey, I like the flint.
I like the flint.
How do flint bars work?
Hmm? If you fail your save versus wand, you're disarmed.
Actually, I kind of like
when
that.
Whenever they hit you.
And of course, wand is the rod, staff, and wand is a stand-in for saving versus any aimed object.
So it's a right? Dodge save.
It's a dodge save. It's the get out of the way save. Yeah.
But you still take damage even if you make your save.
But it's different than the breath weapon get out of the way save, because breath weapon implies you're going to dive for cover, not just, you know. You're not ducking a beam, you're getting out of the entire area.
Right.
It's also the hardest saving throw to make, which is interesting.
Except for wizards, which is kind of odd.
Yeah.
And why are wizards good at that saving throw?
Which ones? Or are we talking about breath weapons?
Wait, what are we making? No, we're talking about breath weapons.
Oh, breath weapons. Yeah, breath weapons are the hardest to make, except for fighters.
I think fighters just tough it out. They just, and the fire washes over them, they're okay.
Which is the advantage of wearing plate mail.
And magic plate mail gives you bonuses to your saving throw versus breath weapon.
Hey, there's an idea.
Do you get a saving throw versus, say, green dragon breath weapon from your plate mail? I would say no.
No.
But here's an idea. How about a magical suit of armor where it gives you just a +8 on your breath weapon saves, in addition to having like a +1?
Well, there's a Dragon Magazine article back in the day about enchanted armor from made from dragonhide, and one of the things it gave you was a bonus versus breath weapons from the if you enchanted it properly. That wasn't a bad idea, if I remember correctly. That's 30 years ago, and I've got brain damage, so who knows what it really said. But
let's see what else.
What are they? Do we have any unhorse effects? Like, can you unhorse people with weapons in first edition?
And you know everything.
Does not appear so.
Does not.
Oh wait, yes. Also the Wand Sword.
Seriously?
The Hewson Hammer. Everything with the word Grisarm in it. The Military Fork. The Faucet. The Faucet Fork.
Pole arms can unhorse you.
Many pole arms can unhorse you. What's the mechanic on that?
If you hit this unhorse.
Yes, but this is less broken because really, when are you going to be fighting mounted people in the first edition? You'd have to roll nomads or evil adventurers.
Nomads are scary.
Yeah.
Why are nomads scary?
Well, besides the fact that they can randomly...
Yevold Mongols!
Besides the fact that they can have a randomly generated 15th level cleric...
That's pilots. They can only have a randomly generated 13th level cleric.
Oh, so, yeah, you can end up with leveled Mongols...
better now.
Yes.
Yeah, really. Leveled Mongols only have a maximum of a 13th level cleric.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
Of course, he can probably cast spells while riding, so you really want to unhorse that guy.
So, in other words, you got an evil Mongol that can actually cast Slay Living from horseback?
Yes.
Oh yeah, you can do the casting time while his horse moves, and then you ride by, slap you, and the fighter's down.
No!
And this doesn't sound like something that's randomly generated. This sounds like something where Gary Gigas pulled it on the original party at one point just to laugh while it was probably an attempt to kill Robolar that failed back horribly.
Yeah, Robolar, the most terrifying man in D&D history, who went through Castle Greyhawk to the 13th level by himself. But that leads us to another rambling bit here. There's a strong assumption in first edition that you have henchmen and hirelings with you.
It's almost at a certain point that the difficulty scales with the assumption that you have them.
And where can we see this canonically? If you look at the encounter charts for player characters, enemy player characters, it says this is how many PCs you have, and then you round up with henchmen and men-at-arms until you get X number. I think it's 10. At low levels, it's just men-at-arms, but at high levels, it's henchmen, and how you calculate it. There's an assumption baked into first edition that you have hirelings and henchmen almost immediately.
And you really, really want hirelings and henchmen, because even the hirelings are remarkably nice. Even just getting 6 mercenary shortbowmen could really save your bacon.
Yeah.
Well, another thing, too, is, you know, your camp. You leave your horses behind, you leave your gear behind, all that other stuff. You really need to protect it. How many times have I eaten your lunch because you didn't guard your stuff?
Actually, only the once.
Yeah, but how bad was that?
It was
pretty
bad.
It was
when
pretty
we all
bad.
Take half our mask items because we walked off all our stuff.
Yeah, exactly.
We left our henchmen behind for that.
No, I'm talking about two. It's Skull Mountain.
Oh, yeah.
See, you forgot that one. It was so traumatic you blocked it from your memories.
Yeah, it was Sturges. I easily forget Sturges.
No, it was that guy we let go.
You let a guy go, and he looted your camp and stole your horses and left you stranded in the briars at Skull Mountain.
That's even more stupid than Sturges.
It's more stupid than Sturges, yeah.
Which is impressive.
Stupid than Sturges. All right, guys. Anything else you want to talk about weapons, unusual attacks like unhorsing, or
if you do not see how fast monks hit weapon proficiencies, you do not understand monks.
Very valid point. You have to understand monks, and I've got an article on the blog called "Misunderstood and Improperly Played: The Monk." And I did not mention the fact that boy, do they get a lot of weapon proficiencies, and they're deadly with any weapon known to man. Well, that's it for Don't Split the Party on our little outdoor grilling adventure. You missed the fireworks on the grill and me burning chicken as we spoke about D&D.